On this week's program, a conversation with Philadelphia Orchestra Music Director Christoph Eschenbach. The orchestra begins a Leonard Bernstein Festival this week. As part of it, the orchestra and Time for Three premieres Jennifer Higdon's Concerto for Three. We'll speak with the composer. Susan Lewis looks at the life and legend of Leonard Bernstein, and Jason Pfeiffer talks to the organizers of the annual One Book, One Philadelphia program. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
This week, the Philadelphia Orchestra began its Leonard Bernstein Festival, a series of concerts over several weeks, celebrating the life and legacy of the great American composer, conductor, and educator. Christoph Eschenbach is among the many musicians Bernstein influenced during his lifetime, and when we met recently, I asked him to recall some of the memories he had of the times he spent with Bernstein.
I remember these nights where he was sitting down at the piano and non-stop for 3.5 hours was playing Vienna waltzes by memory of Johann Strauss, the younger, the older, and Oscar Strauss. And there was absolutely amazing and the joy he had with his Viennese music. And also how he, in the same time, lectured about it and about how one has to play it and about the certain beat in it, in the waltz or in the polka. And of course, this I remember. And I remember also when he talked about the Bible. And he knew many, many things by memory. He could sing, and I was also witness of that, Jeremiah's Psalms. And that was so impressive. He was once in Canary Islands. He was standing in this rocky landscape, the sun, and planting a tree and blessing it with this wonderful singing a psalm, in Hebrew, of course. But he made it so clear that one could actually understand every word without understanding the words. One could understand the sense and the... Of course, afterwards he translated it. And so many wonderful memories of this great man come up if I dig it.
He was also a very kind man, kind with his understanding of life and his knowledge.
Sure, he was also very liberal, enormously liberal in politics, of course, and liberal in any humanitarian side. And he was wonderful with young people. He cared very much for young people. Look, the young people's concerts he created. They are still reissued now on DVD. And they are still absolutely up-to-date and popular and enormously instructive and not at all condescending. That is something also which should be pointed out, because whoever it was that he conversed with, he never was condescending, never.
A lot of the time when you hear somebody who's been influenced by Bernstein, you can almost immediately say he's done something Bernsteinian, or that's very Bernstein. But what is that? What is the Bernstein stamp? Can you describe it to us?
It's very difficult to describe in words, because there's a certain melisma he has in melodies, and there's a certain offbeat rhythm which only he has. He certainly has his own language, and you recognize immediately that it is by Bernstein. Even with his early work, Jeremiah, it's a very, very Bernstein language. He studied at this time, amongst others, with Hindemith in Tanglewood. And there's also some strain of Hindemithian things, but it's really 99% already true Bernstein. And that's rather amazing for a young person, that he has found his style right away. And how I approach it, well, I approach it as any good music. I can identify with it 100%. And people who want to copy that, and many people try to copy that, they are as you said, it sounds Bernsteinian, but it doesn't sound like Bernstein.
Philadelphia Orchestra music director Christoph Eschenbach. As the orchestra celebrates what would have been Leonard Bernstein's 90th birthday, it's more difficult to gauge what his influence might have been had he not died somewhat prematurely in 1990, aged 72. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the life, legend, and legacy of Leonard Bernstein and his continuing influence over the classical music world of today.
Leonard Bernstein touched many different audiences in his 72 years. His high-profile roles as conductor of the New York Philharmonic and composer of popular works like West Side Story and Candide put him in a celebrity spotlight that blinded some to his many other accomplishments and talents. His compositions include 3 symphonies, a concerto, operas, choral works, and chamber music, as well as many works for Broadway, ballet, and film. His conducting took him all over the world. His desire to teach took him to Brandeis and Harvard Universities, Tanglewood, and into homes across America and beyond, where he introduced a whole new generation of people to music through his Young People's Concerts.
I remember as a kid watching these on TV.
David Booth grew up to be a violinist in the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I came from an area where there was not a whole lot of classical music, sort of the wilds of West Virginia, and that was a very, very important thing, and I'm sure for many, many people outside of the large metropolitan areas, especially just outside of New York, that was classical music to us. It was the real thing.
Leonard Bernstein, Lenny, to his friends, associates, and as the years went by, a growing gaggle of groupies, was both a citizen of the world and uniquely American. Growing up the child of Jewish immigrant parents in the eclectic 20th century cultural mix of pop, Western classical music, and American jazz, he became a conductor, composer, pianist, author, educator, and social activist in no particular order, although perhaps sitting at the piano was where it all began. Born on August 25, 1918, near Boston, Bernstein started piano lessons when he was 10. When he was 16, he went to Harvard University, where he majored in music. His senior thesis was entitled The Absorption of Race Elements into American Music. This sensitivity to the turmoil of the world would continue, and his daughter Jamie Bernstein says the issues he grappled with mirrored the struggles of others.
He wrestled with notions of faith and despair and optimism and pessimism. You can hear this struggle right in the notes of his music, and I think that's one of the reasons why his music still speaks so urgently to us today.
After Harvard, Bernstein came to the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. From Curtis, he went to Tanglewood. On his 25th birthday, he became assistant conductor of the New York Philharmonic. Just a few months later, on November 14, 1943, he filled in for an ailing Bruno Walter, stepping onto the podium at Carnegie Hall in a performance that was broadcast nationally. But the boy wonder of American classical music was just getting started. Early the next year, he conducted the premiere of his first symphony, Jeremiah, with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Noted music writer Barrymore Scherer says even at this young age, Bernstein was breaking new ground.
It's remarkably well-mannered, and yet it sort of breaks the rules. The very end, for instance, the last text is sung by a soprano. To those who knew Jewish liturgy, this was a remarkable break with tradition, and yet it's a break with tradition within tradition.
Over the next 15 years, from 1943 to 1958, Bernstein worked and lived intensely. He married Chilean-born actress Felicia Montealegre, with whom he had 3 children. He conducted European orchestras, produced his second symphony, The Age of Anxiety, and composed more music for Broadway and film, including the soundtrack for On the Waterfront. In the late 1950s, the stars seemed to align for Bernstein. When he was 38 years old, the German premiere of his musical Wonderful Town opened in Vienna. His operetta Candide premiered in New York, and the next fall, West Side Story burst onto Broadway. West Side Story would go on to even greater success in film. Against this backdrop of popular success, he became music director of the New York Philharmonic, a podium from which he would expose thousands to classical music through his televised series of young people's concerts. In the concert hall itself, his programming included both classics and new music. And before it became fashionable to do so, he would sometimes talk to audiences at concerts, especially if the music was intriguing or challenging in some way. His conducting was notoriously physical. Philadelphia Orchestra cellist Richard Harlow recalls that even later in life, Bernstein conducted with his whole body.
He was literally jumping up and down on the podium. And we finished, and he's totally, totally out of breath. He wasn't really saving anything for the concert. You know, he did it during the rehearsal as well.
Yet his unconventional decorum, his effervescence on the podium, and his popular appeal prompted harsh criticism from some of New York's established music critics, who seemed to view him more as an interloper than a serious classical conductor or composer. Meanwhile, the social turmoil of the 60s found expression in Bernstein's music. President Kennedy's death moved Bernstein to write his third symphony, Kaddish. Controversial ideas were not new to Bernstein, in his music or in his life. Over the years, his support of various causes had earned him an FBI file, from judging musical auditions sponsored by the National Negro Congress in 1945 to his 1959 tour stop in Russia with the New York Philharmonic. In 1969, Bernstein left the Philharmonic with the title of Conductor Laureate. A chain-smoking, flamboyant maestro, he had near rock star celebrity, complete with fawning entourage. He continued conducting, touring, composing, teaching, and acting on behalf of political causes, including opening his home to a 1970 fundraiser for the Black Panthers. He performed all over the world for heads of state and religious leaders. In 1973, he led a concert for peace at the National Cathedral in Washington and began a lecture series at Harvard. The intensity of his professional and personal life eventually took its toll on his health and morale. Leonard Bernstein died at age 72 in 1990. His legacy is as eclectic as was his life. After leaving the New York critics behind, his international success vindicated him as a conductor in the eyes of the American music establishment. Yet the mass appeal of his theater and film music also worked against him as a classical composer. Bernstein's music is infused with energy and rhythms and a sense of combining genres and reaching beyond conventional boundaries. Musician David Booth says for many years, major orchestras didn't often play his symphonies.
There's a snob element in a lot of classical music because Bernstein was so popular and made it so popular with the West Side Story and things like this into Broadway, they stick up their nose at his so-called serious work. And I'm sorry, they're both equally valid and they're both equally wonderful.
Today, although the man is gone, Bernstein's music and influence are very much alive. His personal charisma is legendary. Musicians revere him. Conductors and composers lay claim to his legacy. From musical prodigy to aging icon, Leonard Bernstein made music a joyous and exciting event, and he flung the doors wide open, inviting everyone inside.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Philadelphia Orchestra's Leonard Bernstein Festival began this week with the unveiling of a newly commissioned work by Philadelphia-based composer Jennifer Higdon, a concerto for orchestra and string trio. Higdon created Concerto for Three, especially for Time for Three, and it had its first performance at Verizon Hall on Thursday. Another Higdon commission for solo violin and orchestra, also written in honor of Leonard Bernstein, will be debuted by the orchestra with violinist Jennifer Coe this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. When I spoke with Jennifer Higdon last month, she had just given the soloists their new compositions.
There's something very appropriate about the fact that the soloists that are involved in this Time for Three, Jennifer Coe, who's a violinist, is just wonderful. And also the director of the Philadelphia Singers, who are going to be a part of this concert, all attended Curtis, where Leonard Bernstein attended school. And I was looking at his picture yesterday, actually, at Curtis, there on the wall, looking like a student. And I was thinking about the incredible legacy. This man did so much for classical music with his young person's concerts. He was an amazing educator. My gosh, he taught so many conductors, actually, up at Tanglewood and in other places. And I was talking recently even to Maren Alsop, and she was a Bernstein protege. This man touched so many people in so many different ways. It's kind of staggering. But I think he also influenced all the composers who have come along in the American vernacular. The music, the rhythms of our current American sound, I think all kind of come down from Leonard Bernstein. I think his West Side Story and his symphonic works, I think they're kind of a real gift to the world.
There is a sort of a Bernsteinian gesture that's much imitated. Is there ever a temptation to go that route when you're doing something, or was there a temptation to go that route when you were writing something in his honor?
You know, I think probably the closest tribute to him is the Time for Three piece, Concerto 4-3, because it kind of bends genres a little bit. I mean, he was always interested in bringing in unusual instruments. He used electric guitar sometimes, and it's unusual to have two violins and a bass playing classical music that has a little bit of a bluegrass bend. So I think that's probably the closest tribute to him. And you know what? I think about the quality of the music making that that guy was responsible for, an immense amount of it in this country. And so you always aspire when you're writing to match the quality of the other things that are going to be on the program. So that was always in my mind. But I think probably Bernstein would have been really interested to hear the works on these programs.
And was it... Is it more important that you're writing for the people who are going to perform, or that you write for the person who the piece is in honor of?
Ah, that's a good question. I probably had so many conversations with these performers, so I'd say that probably for me was the primary focus. Time for Three is such an unusual group that I had to figure out a way to capture their essence in a piece, and it was tricky because you want it to be a serious piece of music, but you also want it to have open the possibilities of improvisation, because these guys are so good at it. And they play so much different music, so it was a really interesting challenge trying to create something that would fit them. And what will be really interesting for people, if they hear both pieces, the Singing Rooms, which I wrote for Jennifer Coe, that also has a chorus, and then this Concerto 4-3, the pieces are pretty different. They're actually... There's enough difference that there may be some people say, is that the same composer? But it was important to kind of capture the essence of the two players. Jennifer Coe, I know, because I've written a solo sonata for her that was premiered here in Philly, actually last October at the Kimmel Center Presents. And it was interesting to get to know her writing and then to explore that even further beyond the sonata that I wrote for her. But also, I've known the Time for Three guys a long time. I've known Zach DePuy since he was like 7 years old, because he was in Bowling Green where I was going to school. He used to zip around the music building, see how fast he could run, because it's kind of in a circular pattern. So I'd see Zach running around at high speed, tearing around the building. And I think back on that, I'm like, boy, that's a guy with a lot of energy. I better write a lot of notes.
Both groups of musicians now have these compositions in their hands. What's the reaction been, first of all, from Time for Three?
Time for Three's been really, really excited. We've just gone through a lot of hours of rehearsing for the past 2 days, probably about 13 hours, 14 hours even, and they're really hyped up. They figured out a way to do the cadenzas and the improv sections. They match what I've written, and they're so excited. And there's already been kind of an overwhelming response in the orchestral community. People are already asking when they can do the work, which, boy, that's the ultimate compliment. We still haven't premiered it, and people are already asking when they can do it. So, and the wonderful thing, I talked the other day with Jennifer Coe. She says, you know what, now that I've done your sonata, I know what your language is like. It's challenging because it's a concerto, but I know what you want. I know what the rhythms are, the feeling and the gestures. And I said, well, do I need to change anything? I always ask the soloist, do you need something changed? Have I written anything that's impossible? And she said, no, actually, all the gestures are going to take work, but they should work just fine.
Thank you.
excerpt from Jennifer Higdon's Concerto for Three for String Trio and Orchestra, the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Christoph Eschenbach with Time for Three, recorded live at Verizon Hall on Thursday. There are two further premiere performances of this work, tonight and on Tuesday evening at 8. The Philadelphia Orchestra's Leonard Bernstein Festival continues through February 2nd.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This week, the Free Library of Philadelphia and the Mayor's Office launched the 2008 One Book, One Philadelphia program. The annual project is designed to promote literacy and library use by encouraging area residents to read and discuss a single book over a 2.5 month period. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, now in its 6th year, the citywide reading initiative and the library itself continue to expand.
Libraries often have the reputation of being very quiet, subdued, and even stuffy, literally and figuratively. But walk into the main branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia, just off the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, and you'll find a buzz of activity. People constantly walking through, chatting, checking out books, adults reading to children. Opened in 1894, the Free Library of Philadelphia has long been a mainstay in the cultural life of the region. From its early days in 3 cramped rooms in City Hall, to its now 54 branches throughout the city and a collection of more than 6 million items, the local libraries are community hubs in ways that few institutions can match. The sprawling system and its programs affect thousands of people every day. Since its inception in 2003, the One Book, One Philadelphia program has become a centerpiece of the Free Library's programming. Murray Field, chair of the One Book Project since 2004, says that in a short time, the program has become a beloved tradition for many in the region.
I think it has exceeded everybody's expectations year by year. The project has really taken hold.
One Book, One Philadelphia is not a new concept. Field says similar programs have popped up in cities across the country. But the breadth of Philadelphia's initiative is notable. Just from 2007 to this year, the number of community partners, museums, schools, businesses, and social service agencies grew from 400 to 500. The growth in partnerships is in part due to the interest in this year's book selection, What is the What? By Dave Eggers. The novel is a hybrid of memoir and fiction, based on the life and experiences of Valentino Achak Deng. One of the so-called lost boys, Deng was born in Sudan and as a child witnessed many atrocities during the country's civil war. The book recounts Deng's forced flight from war-torn Sudan to Ethiopia, Kenya, and finally the United States, where he now lives. The novel explores the experience of refugees in the United States and the impact of violence on children, not only in Africa, but also in America. Describing the book as the kind of story that can engender understanding about these kind of issues in ways that mere statistics and the news cannot, Marie Field says One Book, One Philadelphia selections, like What is the What, help create unity.
Having a book as the focal point allows us to engage with each other in a way that brings all different people, people from our diverse population together in very meaningful ways. They start out talking about the book. They end up relating to each other.
In past years, more than 10,000 people have participated annually in the One Book, One Philadelphia program. So when selecting a book each year, organizers are faced with a tall order to find a book that appeals to a diverse audience. There are other criteria, such as excellent literary quality, easily read by 11th graders and up, and having a living author, so that writers like Dave Eggers can come and share their insights about their book, as Eggers did this past week with a lecture at the Free Library.
I'll just tell the story about how What is the What came about. In 2002, I got a letter in the mail from a woman named Mary Williams.
A committee of about 20 people start meeting in the early summer months to begin the selection process for One Book, One Philadelphia. They are invited to submit book suggestions, and once a list of dozens of books are compiled, all the books must be read and evaluated. CEO of the Free Library Foundation, Linda Johnson, says the initial winnowing process for the committee isn't too bad. It quickly becomes clear what books wouldn't be a good fit. What's difficult, she says, is going from the last five books to the actual selection.
And that's where it gets a little bit heated. We have blind votes and we have impassioned pleas from members of the committee who are lobbying for their selection. We get letters from people saying that they would hope that we would consider this book. I mean, people are very persistent about this. So I don't think anybody's gotten bruised, physically bruised, but I'm sure that there have been some emotional bruises along the way.
The goal of One Book, One Philadelphia is to build community, encourage library use, and promote literacy in the city. Literacy, in the traditional sense, relates to reading, but Linda Johnson says the library's definition of literacy is no longer limited to print. That's reflected in this year's implementation of the One Film, One Philadelphia program. The film, with similar themes to What is the What, will be announced in late January, and from February 21st to March 6th, will be screened and discussed at schools, libraries, community centers, and film venues across Philadelphia. In addition to book and film literacy, Johnson sees the possibility of One Philadelphia offerings in other areas, such as music.
Our definition of literacy is evolving all the time, and as it evolves, so will the One Book, One Philadelphia program.
But in the meantime, One Book, One Philadelphia remains at the core. And to enhance understanding and appreciation of this year's book, program manager Jerry Truskin says over 180 events are planned throughout the region.
We have dance programs happening and music performances and Sudanese cooking instruction and African storytelling and art projects. And we've tried to accommodate and augment the reading experience as much as we possibly can.
All said and done, the Free Library will distribute about 10,000 copies of What is the What for 2008's One Book, One Philadelphia. In light of all the discussion and ancillary programming on the docket over the next few months, there's probably no other One Book that Philadelphia as a whole will be talking more about this year.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. One Book, One Philadelphia runs through March 20th. And that's our show. Our thanks this week to Catherine Bodgett and Lauren Saul. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.